This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Phase 4 of the Massachusetts reopening starts today. Boston moves forward with the rest of Phase 3, Step 2. That means indoor and outdoor stadiums can begin to reopen at 12% once they submit a capacity plan to the Department of Public Health. Exhibition and convention halls can also begin operating, and indoor theaters and performance venues can open. But will they? With Massachusetts COVID-19 cases plateauing, we're at an average rate of about 1,500 per day. Epidemiologists are warning that the threat of another surge remains, and data from arts polling suggests that it could be some time before the arts industry returns to what we might call a more recognizable version of normal. Joining us today to talk about that is Catherine Peterson, the Executive Director of Arts Boston, a 175-member arts organization that supports and advocates for the arts and culture sector in Greater Boston. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be with you.
So let me just check in with you first. You're an advocate for the arts. What does it mean to be able to reopen theaters and performance venues for the arts and culture sector as a whole?
I think what it means to not only me, but to my colleagues who run theater, music, dance, performing arts organization, it means being able to open up at a time when audiences are ready to come, when they've been vaccinated, when we've had time to ramp up, to rehire staff, book artists, rehearse, put PPE protocols in place, actually sell tickets, and also to make sure that the situation is in place where our distinctive business model, where we need to have audiences at bigger than 50% in order to operate, are allowable. So it's going to be a while. I don't think you're going to see a lot of concert halls and theaters opening up their doors today or in the next few weeks.
So to that point, and there's a lot there, what I think I essentially hear you saying is we are excited to reopen, but that's a lift, both in terms of putting things back together and getting our audiences ready. One of our producers spoke with Temple Gill, who is the director of public affairs, one of your member organizations, the Huntington Theater Company. And even though Huntington, like the others, can begin to, Temple Gill was saying something similar to what we just heard from you. They're not planning to have any in-person shows until Labor Day. Here's what Temple had to say about reopening.
We know that just because we're allowed to reopen now doesn't necessarily mean that audiences are going to be ready to come back. A majority of our audiences have told us that they're eager to return to performances, thank goodness, which is great news, but getting vaccinated and getting to herd immunity is a priority.
So Catherine, you know, I felt that thank goodness that we just heard from Temple there, but also, you know, herd immunity is not something theaters can control themselves. So what are the controllables for performance organizations, and what is at the mercy of how the larger public health situation unfolds?
Well, you know, there actually are some really good things, some really great indicators that really build upon the excitement that Temple was expressing. And that is, we know from the research that we at Arts Boston have been doing with arts organizations like the Huntington, is that Boston arts audiences want to get vaccinated. 96% of them will or probably will get vaccinated, and they also want to get vaccinated right away. But we know that's going to take time for folks just opened up to people 60 and above today. So that's number one. They're also going to want to make sure that protocols are in place. They're going to want to make sure that arts organizations are providing safe places where mass enforcement will happen, where other protocols around social distancing and also ventilation. That's the good news, is that our arts colleagues are being incredibly thoughtful about their venues and making sure that things are in place before we open the doors.
So I'm hearing, you know, measured, thoughtful, one step at a time. I'm also mindful of the losses for the arts community. According to a report from the Massachusetts Cultural Council Last week, the arts and culture sector here in the Commonwealth lost $588 million during the pandemic, and $423 million of that came from the greater Boston area. So at the same time, there's this massive financial loss, massive financial pressure. How do arts institutions sit in that dichotomy, right? Carry that dichotomy. And when does the financial healing start, do you think?
It's been devastating. It's really been a financial freefall for the last year. Boston arts organizations rely so much on earned income, and that's ticket sales, concessions. We've had a year without that. And we know that we can't really reopen until we can do so. And it makes sense in terms of being able to pay our expenses and cover them. So the way what's really needed right now, in addition to relying on amazing audiences who have been so supportive, but it's going to take more than that. Given the impact that the arts have in Greater Boston in terms of both being an economic driver, yet also the arts are going to be critical to helping to heal, helping to bring people together as a community. So we're really relying on the state to understand the commitment that is needed from them with the federal stimulus money that will be coming, and making sure that that's part of bringing back the arts community so we can be part of the healing, we can be part of the economic recovery.
And in your gut, given that public health officials are pushing back hard on the Commonwealth and other states right now that are moving forward with reopening, given everything else you've just said, in your gut, when is the right time for performance venues, theaters, to open their doors and actively be performing?
I think it is when enough folks have been vaccinated, and that certainly is not yet. It is when folks have their protocols in place, and it is when it makes economic sense. A great example of an institution that's doing a very thoughtful job of this is the Boston Symphony Orchestra, which announced a partial reopening of Tanglewood this summer. They aren't doing it. They're doing it at a loss, but for a very specific reason, and they can do that. They're able to do it, but they have 4 months to ramp up and get everything in place. It's all outside. And that's 4 months where audiences will be getting vaccinated. So that's a perfect example for an outdoor venue. And I think that, and again, it's based on what happens, we'll probably be looking at the fall for the majority of other arts organizations indoors to be opening up.
All right, Executive Director of Arts Boston, Catherine Peterson. Catherine, appreciate you joining Radio Boston today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The petition for a writ of certiorari is granted. Those nine words today from the U.S. Supreme Court mean nine justices will consider an appeal of the First Circuit's decision last summer to overturn Jihad Tsarnaev's death sentence. Now, remember, Tsarnaev was convicted of all 30 charges against him and sentenced to death in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Joining us now for more is retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be back.
All right, so I want to comb this out correctly, Judge Gertner. My understanding is the appeal is about the legality of jury selection in the Tsarnaev case. But what's at stake is whether Tsarnaev receives the death penalty. Is that right?
Right. It's also about the failure to admit evidence of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's triple murder in Waltham. And so it's two things. One was jury selection, and the other was evidence that was excluded from the penalty phase.
And the thought was that those, I don't know what the right word is, Judge Gertner, mistakes or failure then led to an outcome that called the sentence of death into question?
That's right. That's right.
So can you walk us through that just a little?
Well, it's only with respect to the penalty phase, because as you recall, Tsarnaev agreed that he had done the crime. So it was only the penalty phase. And it was a question of asking a juror whether anything you heard about this case has led you to, would interfere with your ability to be fair, rather than asking, what did you know about the case? And the first question, anything you know would lead you to be unfair in this case, allows the juror to decide, well, let's see. I watched it with bated breath and I know every detail, but don't worry, I can be fair. Essentially, the juror is making the determination of whether they can be fair. And the argument is that the rule, particularly in a case as high profile as this, requires the judge to make that determination. Tell me what you know. Tell me what you heard about the case. Tell me your impression. Then I'll decide whether it is fair. So that was the first issue. And the second issue was the argument of the defense was that essentially Jokar was intimidated by his older brother, and therefore the failure to allow the defense to introduce evidence about which Jokar was aware that his brother had committed a triple murder in Waltham was error. How could the jury have not heard that? If they had, they would have understood that he was a frightening and intimidating presence.
All right, so with that in mind, the First Circuit, based on that argument, overturned a death sentence. What are the implications of the U.S. Supreme Court deciding to consider this case and possibly reverse the First Circuit's ruling from July?
If the Supreme Court reverses the ruling, then it will go back to the U.S. First Circuit. And the reason it would go back is that there were a number of issues that the court didn't get to. In other words, the court finds issue one and two is enough to throw out this conviction, this penalty. And so we won't get to the rest of the catalog of errors. One part of the catalog of errors that they'd have to get back to is the accusation that two of the jurors committed essentially misconduct by not disclosing social media postings, even after they had been told not to post and told to disclose what they had posted. So this is not the end of it. Even if the Supreme Court overturns the ruling with respect to these issues, there are still other issues that the First Circuit has to deal with.
So that begs the question, for those who don't want to relive, for example, victims' families, who don't want to be reliving this trial all the time, this is an ongoing saga for the cities, the families. How will the Supreme Court's involvement impact that ongoing pain? It sounds like this could drag things out further.
It certainly could. It's not unusual in a death penalty case for there to be multiple appeals. That's not unusual, particularly because it's the ultimate punishment. I should add that one argument that the defense has made, and I imagine will be making to the Biden administration, is Jokar had admitted to the crime, was prepared to take life imprisonment years and years ago, all that pain could have been eliminated if they had simply not put the death penalty on the table. Then he would have been in prison over 5 years ago, and it would have been over. So, yes, it's terribly troubling for the victims, but the way out of that was 5 years ago, and perhaps even now, if the government decides to take the death penalty off the table.
So to that point, so the push that led to the July 2020 ruling was spearheaded under the last president, President Donald Trump. Now we have a new president, Joe Biden. You mentioned him a moment ago. He has been a death penalty opponent. He pledged that as a president, he would, quote, work to pass legislation to eliminate the death penalty federally, end quote. Hasn't done that yet, hasn't reinstated the moratorium on the federal death penalty. But anywhere in this process, is it in fact the case that the death penalty could be taken off the table by the administration and simply no longer a part of the picture for the Boston Marathon bomber?
Yes, although I have to correct you. The death penalty decision was made in the Obama administration, was not a Trump decision. But Trump certainly has hastened death penalty executions under his watch. But yes,
to overturn back was under the Trump administration, right? And I'm not being defensive. I just want to understand how this is playing out at the presidential level.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Biden indicated that he was inclined to both reinstate the moratorium and to reconsider the death penalty. Trump, of course, took a completely different position. At any time, the government could, in deference to the concerns that you're raising, for example, about the victims, could say death penalty is off the table, in which case the case is over, just over.
Last question for you, Judge Gertner. This is an announcement that the Supreme Court is going to consider, so this won't happen for a while. A decision won't come for a while. But could the court decide something here that is precedent-setting that we need to watch for?
Well, it's possible. This is a unique set of facts in the Tsarnaev case. So the unique set of facts here was a case that the defense at least argued should never have taken place in Boston because Boston was the victim. This is not just the usual pretrial publicity situation. This is a situation where everyone was locked down for a period of time, might well have been on that finish line in other years. And given that, the obligation to do a fair jury selection is even more substantial than in the ordinary case. So, yes, it could be precedent. We are getting more and more high-profile cases like Chauvin, for example, the police officer who killed, accused of killing George Floyd. Yes, we're getting many more high-profile cases, and so this could be precedent for that. But on the other hand, this is a pretty unique set of facts here. So the answer is a wishy-washy answer, uncharacteristic of me. But is
I can live with it, though. We'll come back and talk about this more. Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Great to talk to you, Judge Gertner. Thanks for coming back.
Great to talk to you, too. Bye-bye.
Last week's shootings in Atlanta that killed 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian and 7 of whom were women, are reverberating throughout the Asian and Asian American communities here in the Commonwealth. At a press conference Friday, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh noted that this is an emotional and frightening time for the Asian American and Pacific Islander communities and is asking Bostonians to step up against anti-Asian American hate.
Do not tolerate any hateful comments or stereotypes. We're asking you to speak up if you see them happening in our city. We need to be intentional about eradicating racism out of our communities.
Now, this conversation, this act of violence comes in the midst of a pandemic that has made Asian Americans and Pacific Islander Americans targets of xenophobic and racial discrimination. And we want to talk about what all that means here in our communities in the Commonwealth today. And we want to invite you to join the conversation. If you are Asian American or Pacific Islander American, what has your experience been throughout this pandemic? Have you experienced instances of hostility, you seeing yourself as an ally? Are you practicing allyship? Maybe you've attended a rally or a vigil. We'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. 2 guests join us for this conversation. The first is Angie Liu, Executive Director of the Asian Community Development Corporation, and Danielle Kim, member of the Massachusetts Asian American Commission. Angie, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. Danielle, same to you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here today and to speak with you about this issue.
So, Danielle, I'm going to ask you both this question, but I'll start with you, Danielle. Share with us, if you're willing, your reactions to the Atlanta shootings and how you feel they're reverberating in the AAPI community here in the Commonwealth.
Certainly. I can share that ever since I heard the news, I've had a deep knot in my chest. I've found it hard to take full exhales. I've had trouble sleeping, and I have shed many tears. This has been such a difficult time for the AAPI community, and I have been grieving and mourning alongside my fellow Asian American friends, specifically Asian women, and it's deeply troubling. And at the same time, I'm angry. I am angry that it took a violent, traumatic hate crime of this scale and magnitude for Asian American discrimination and racism to come to the public consciousness like we've seen this week. And so it's very complex, the feelings that I have at this moment. And I'm still processing and I'm still grieving. And it is deeply challenging to just keep up with everything that I'm supposed to do in day-to-day life when I know that our community is dealing with so much right now.
I'm sorry, Danielle. Angie, does that resonate with you?
Absolutely, Tiziana. Danielle, I hear you. I share a lot of the same feelings and emotions. But I do want to call people's attention to the fact that the shooting in Atlanta and even the physical assaults against Asian elders in California and New York that we've seen over last month, they did not occur in a vacuum. My organization, you know, has been working in Chinatown for over 30 years. And I have to say, over the last 12 months, we have already been dealing with all of the fallout from COVID. You know, Chinatown, as well as the Asian community, already began to experience economic hardship from COVID, as well as rising anti-Asian sentiment very early on a year ago. And so I just want to remind people that these incidents are not new. And it is sad, as Daniel pointed out, that it takes a horrific shooting like in Atlanta that really calls the nation's attention to this issue.
Daniel, what other context, as Angie just gave us, what other context do you want people to process this moment in?
Yeah, Tiziana, when you ask me that, the first thing I think about is how I've seen some media coverage about the Atlanta shooting described, you know, in a way that, oh, you know, this racism, discrimination, and violence is so un-American. This is not who we are. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, unfortunately, this is very American. The violence and racism and misogyny that has been perpetrated against our community is deeply embedded into the fabric of this country and has been occurring for over 150 years. I think to Asian American history and how these instances, and I think about the number of policies that have intentionally and deliberately excluded and marginalized and exploited the Asian American community throughout the course of 150 years. And as Angie said, this is not new. This is a cumulative burden that our community has been dealing with ever since we stepped foot in this country.
Listeners, I want to welcome you into this conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you experienced, I don't want to say incidences because that isolates, and we're talking about a larger picture, but have you experienced racism as an Asian American or Pacific Islander American? Have you gone to a vigil or attended another event to show allyship over the last week? What's our next step as a country? So, Angie, building on what Danielle just said, I want to play just a moment from Vice President Kamala Harris speaking in Atlanta a few days ago.
Everyone has the right to go to work, to go to school, to walk down the street and be safe, and also the right to be recognized as an American, not as the other.
She said everyone, and those are universal needs, those are universal rights. And I feel like the two of you are inviting us to have a larger conversation about how systemic racism affects Asian Americans and Pacific Islander Americans, just as we over the last nearly 12 months now have been having a sustained conversation about how racism and anti-Blackness has affected the Black community in America. So let's talk a little bit more about the larger systemic issues that need to be on the table. Maybe Angie.
Yes, I'm happy to jump in here. You know, it's great to hear elected officials jump in and make statements. Many companies and other corporations have also made statements, but you know, what I question is always is statements are easy, right? To say that no one should have to live through this, you know, everyone should have the same rights. So what are we going to do about it as a country? What are next steps? And I think a lot of the focus right now, the immediate, is on beefing up hate crime reporting, hate crime legislation, and that's great. But I think that is only a limited slice of the picture in terms of broader solutions. And this ties back to what you were talking about in terms of looking at the systemic racism. Because what we are witnessing in terms of the murders, as well as the earlier incidents of physical assault against Asian elders, these are individual acts of racism that people experience, right? And so hate crime goes after the individuals, the so-called perpetrators, and it ignores and it does not address the underlying systemic racism and systemic violence against our countries. So when you're talking about a long history of this country's Chinatowns being displaced and disappeared through gentrification, that is a form of violence. when you're talking about our AAPI elders, immigrant elders, who cannot access vaccines because of language barriers, that is a form of racist violence. And so we're trying to think about community-based solutions that really try to get at systemic racism by trying to devote more resources to grassroots organizations that have these relationships, that have trust in a community, and that are doing this work and trying to increase resources in housing, jobs, healthcare, and education.
I'm going to go to the phones here, 1-800-8255. We have Robert on the line from Arlington. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I am an Asian American. I'm actually biracial Asian, and I'm in my early 50s. So I have definitely grown up with anti-Asian sentiment most of my life, even into my recent adult life. So it's definitely a reality for me. What I feel like is, unfortunately, I think as a society, our discussions around racism tend to fall into the very simplistic extreme. No pun intended, but they tend to fall along, you know, very black and white issues. And so I have my, you know, my friends, my coworkers, my colleagues who are African-American. Obviously, I feel that they have a much more difficult experience than I've had. But at the same time, I feel like when I try to share my experience, a lot of times I feel like it's not heard. That there is hatred, there is fear, you know, anxiety around the Asian community, AAPI community, and I feel like it's being exacerbated with everything that's happening with the pandemic, but it's nothing new. And so I think it's sad that this had to happen, but I'm glad that we're starting to have this discussion, and I hope that it actually leads to a productive and healing outcome. So and that's all I'd like to say. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Robert. Danielle, we are at a time in a pluralistic society where we are multiracial in America, and racism has many roots, many manifestations, and many ethnic and racial minorities experience racism. We're also at a time where we are having a reckoning with our history of anti-Blackness in the United States. And then there's this other layer, which is challenges of interracial racism. Are we ready for the complexities of those discussions, and how do we do that tenderly and with healing in mind, as Robert just said? Now, that's like a huge, huge question. Feel free to bite off any piece of it that you want to.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I think it's really important in this time, given our multiracial society, to really think about the ways in which the pain and the experiences and the struggles that the Black community and the Asian community have experienced for so long are so deeply intertwined. And I think that's also a place that deserves further attention and recognition, which is that there have been numerous times throughout American history in which Asian Americans and Black Americans have fought hand in hand together to advance the collective liberation of all of us. And so I think for a long time, Asian Americans have been viewed as a racial wedge, as a way to create and perpetuate infighting among communities of colors. But as Angie mentioned, I think it's really important to recognize that the policies that will support the Asian community are also the ones that will support all communities of color and all immigrant communities. And so I see these battles as deeply intertwined, and that the collective liberation of all of us depends on fighting actively for the liberation and the eradication of hate for any of us.
Angie, let me invite you to just reflect and add there.
I agree. And to your question, Tiziana, about whether we are ready as a society, I don't think we have a choice. I really don't. I think that as difficult as it may sound, we really don't have a choice but to continue the work of building cross-racial alliances and of movement to really undo the systemic racism. And I agree with what Danielle said, is, you know, people sometimes experience these incidents and there's a lot of, you know, sort of almost comparing, you know, oppression Olympics. And I think that misses the point, right? I mean, I think what we are seeing is a commonality, the sources of this racism that both the Asian and the Black and Latinx communities experience is really white supremacy. The white supremacy system wants to divide us and keep us apart and have us continue to fight one another.
I'm going to go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We have Ritu on the line in Framingham. Hello.
Hi. This is the first time I'm on air, so I might be a little nervous.
Don't be nervous. Just go ahead.
Yeah. Past Saturday, I was walking in Calhoun State Park, and I always walk there, and it's a great place. Often meet people, nice people. But that day, I was with my son, and he is very sensitive to people without masks. And he gets really, like, panics if someone is without mask. So I requested a couple ahead of us. They had their mask in their hand. Can they please put the mask on? And the guy got so worked up, and like, why am I asking him to do that? And he started, first he said some sarcasm, and then he started using F language. I only gently reminded him if they could F language, and he threatened me. And me and my son and those people were alone on that trail. It was 6 or 6:30. I don't know. I really deflect anything around racism. Like, it's there. It will be there. We had to adjust those things. But that day, I felt, had he told all those things to anyone else, if there was a man, he would have done that. I don't know if it was racially or something to that. I felt something like that. And
Ritu, I'm glad you shared your experience with us. And I'm so sorry that you went through that and that your child went through that. Thank you for telling us here. I'm going to turn back to Angie and Danielle. And I want to talk about allyship. I want to talk about, now Ritu said that she and her son were alone with this couple in this particular instance. But listeners who are paying close attention and want to know next steps, actions to take, how to show up for others, what are some of the thoughts that you have? And maybe, Danielle, you can start.
Sure. So, Ritu, I first want to extend my deepest apologies and compassion to you and your son for experiencing that. I know personally how hurtful and scary that can be. And I also want to reiterate that these are, again, systemic attempts to silence and intimidate our community that just cannot be tolerated any longer. So, Tiziana, when I think about your question of, you know, what can we do to be allies and to support the Asian community, we need people, all people, to put their own comfort on the line and to speak up whenever they see something. I mean, I think back to the number of racist, misogynistic comments that I've experienced throughout my life. And I think it's really important to recognize that many of them didn't happen in isolation. I had friends and coworkers there with me who overheard the comments and slurs that I experienced, and none of them said anything. And I think that's one of the most painful parts of this. I think back to being in childhood and getting, you know, awful comments about my smelly food, getting my weird Korean middle name made fun of, being asked consistently, where are you really from? And I think about just the layer and the burden of all of those comments and how important it is for people who overhear these things to not let it slide and to speak up every single time. This kind of hate, this kind of racism cannot be tolerated any longer. And we need everyone to not be a bystander, to step in, to join us in demanding that this kind of racism cannot be tolerated in this country.
Angie, other thoughts, things you would add to Danielle's strong points there about allyship, being what's called a co-conspirator, not just supporting, but fighting alongside people?
Yes, several additional ideas. Along the idea of speaking up, there is an organization called Hollaback that does bystander intervention training and gives some concrete tips for folks where if you witness something going on, how to do it in a safe way and how to intervene. So I think that is a great resource, and that's something, you know, anyone can participate. Another thing that I do want to plug is both Danielle's organization, my organization, we are co-sponsoring a town hall on anti-Asian racism this coming Thursday, March 25th at 6 p.m. It will be online. And I would encourage both Asian Americans as well as allies to attend that. Other ways to support is donate to your local Asian American community organizations who are doing this work on the ground. There is an Asian Community Emergency Relief Fund that has been raising and distributing funds to undocumented folks in our community, as well as people who aren't eligible for other public benefits. And lastly is just support policies that would increase resources for our community, whether it's language access, better housing, healthcare, education, as well as data equity, which is really about collecting better data on Asian American communities.
That's great. Thank you. That's Angie Liu, Executive Director of the Asian Community Development Corporation, and Danielle Kim of the Massachusetts Asian American Commission. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diana.
Nearly 200 years ago, the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison of Boston wrote a public letter calling for the end of slavery, saying, quote, "On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm," end quote. It was that spirit that imbued his abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, and others like it. And it's with that spirit that a team from the Boston Globe and Boston University is reviving the abolitionist newspaper tradition under the name of another paper from the era, The Emancipator. Here to discuss that with us is Professor Ibram X. Kendi, founding director of the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research and best-selling author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, also co-founder of The Emancipator. Also joined by Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe, inaugural columnist for The Emancipator, an author of its newsletter, as well as beloved former colleagues. So Kimberly, Professor Kendi, welcome back to Radio Boston to both of you. Ooh, do I have them? Professor Kendi, do I have you?
Yes, you have me. Hello.
Welcome. Welcome. And Kimberly, do I have you? So we might be having some trouble with Kimberly's sound. So Professor Kendi, I'm going to start with you. We talked with you on Radio Boston in July when you first launched Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. Back then, you might remember, although you've done a million interviews since then, I know, we spoke about Boston, the city's history of racism, redlining, busing, professional sports. And even then you brought up in counterpoint this other history of Boston, the city's status as a beacon of the anti-slavery movement in the 19th century. Now we have the launching of the Emancipator in the tradition of the abolitionist newspapers.
Can you hear me now?
Tell us more about that tradition. Kimberly, we can hear you. Welcome. I'm just asking Professor Kendi to tell us a little bit more about the tradition of abolitionist newspapers.
Oh, well, it was just a critically important tradition, you know, from Boston and in other cities in which you had editors and journalists and writers and thinkers who came together to hasten the end of slavery through the written word. And so in many ways, these newspapers served as the voice, you know, of the abolitionist movement then. And you know, we're inspired by that to this day. And we see the way in which journalism, opinion journalism, you know, and scholarship can point the way forward to the abolition of racism.
Kimberly, what did you think when you first heard of this idea?
I thought that it was not only a great idea, but very much needed in the moment we were in. The idea for this project is actually why I left WBUR and rejoined the Boston Globe to be a part of it. Given the last couple of years and the protests that we've seen, the calls for racial justice, it seemed that just the same sort of journalism that sort of follows it and follows where it might go in terms of laws wasn't enough. There really needs to be a discussion that's more forward-looking, that's more broad thinking about what some of the solutions to the racism that are built in so many of our systems might be. And so the opportunity to bring together journalists and scholars and thought leaders and members of the community together to really flesh out and get to the root of not only where this racism lies, but ideas as to how to address them. It feels very much like the calls that were being made in these anti-slavery newspapers 200 years ago.
Kimberly, Professor Kendi a moment ago referred to opinion journalism and scholarship. I think you may have used that same phrase, opinion journalism, at one point. Clearly, this is journalism with a point of view and an approach on a social justice issue. Will this be pushing the envelope of journalism in new ways? Is this that we took a hiatus from a kind of journalism that 200 years ago was widely embraced and accepted? As a journalist, how do you think about that piece of it?
Yeah, you know, I think journalism should always be impactful. I think the lines that were drawn before about what is opinion, what is advocacy, what is proper and what is not, and this, you know, decades-old idea of journalists just being a fly on the wall and just saying the who, what, where, and when, without the why and what comes next, I think is really dated. I think the last several years, last 4 or 5 years have really shown us what it means when journalism does not give the proper context, when it does not clearly delineate between right and wrong, what it means when it does not acknowledge that there is a common good that can be achieved, and certainly fighting against the inherent biases in our communities and in our systems, doing that is in the collective good. So I think it, you know, just like the tradition of these newspapers, I don't think this is taking, certainly don't think it's taking journalism in a negative direction, but certainly broadening the idea of what it can accomplish in a way that many people today may not be used to.
Professor Kendi, do you think there will be a similar kind of conversation on the scholarship and research front?
Well, actually, I hope so. And indeed, I mean, one thing that happens with journalists is journalists are able to speak to, you know, whether through radio or whether through television or certainly through the written word, to everyday people. And scholars are more likely to be publishing in journals and university presses that regular everyday people may not be reading as much. And so for me to be able to work with scholars who can translate their incredibly important research and expertise on different aspects of racism, you know, we just have so many scholars who are studying the intricacies, you know, of racism and pointing the way forward with research-based sort of policy recommendations for their work to be before the American people in ways people can digest is really what excites me as well about The Emancipator.
I wanted to ask the two of you, The Emancipator will rely at least in part and maybe a lot, as I understand it, on private philanthropy, on private giving. I worked in the nonprofit sector for a very long time, and I think we all know that foundations and donors aren't necessarily comfortable putting a lot of funding into things that are on the bleeding edge, that really push the envelope and push boundaries or are not easily measurable. Will there be a tension there, and will it be a challenge to speak, I'll use my word, prophetically, in this set of publications and through these sets of tools, needing to rely on private philanthropy for support? Kimberly, maybe you first.
I don't think so. It shouldn't have to be. I mean, being an alum of public radio, I think there are a lot of things that are innovative and different that public radio stations and public television stations have done with their news, with their journalism, and they certainly rely on that same kind of philanthropy, as well as other ventures that we have seen move forward, like the 19th, the publication that is focused really toward women, women's role in our society, and giving women the information that they need in order to make decisions about the world. And that was groundbreaking in its time, and that's a public endeavor as well. I think when you have that buy-in from outside of the organization, it makes the work even more worthwhile, because you know that it is a joint effort. It's not about, you know, it's not about trying to profit or have that bottom line. It's about people really coming together, endeavoring for a common goal. And I think it's actually a benefit here.
Professor Kendi, is there anything you want to add to that?
I mean, I think Kim said it beautifully.
All right, so let's Let's explore another piece here. And I don't know if either of you heard any of our conversation before the break, but we were talking about the experiences of the Asian American and Pacific Islander American communities, especially over the last year and in the wake of the shootings in Atlanta. And we were talking about the way our country has started to reckon with anti-Blackness and now other forms of racism. That's striking to me because slavery can't be separated from our history of anti-Blackness in America. And you are channeling the traditions of anti-slavery newspapers. On the other hand, Dr. Kendi, in reading your work, you've been clear that anti-racism efforts are not exclusively limited to one race. So in the balance of content, how do the two of you imagine the emancipator in the reporting and the scholarship in tackling anti-Blackness, broader forms of racism? What is that balance there? How should we think about it? Professor Kendi, maybe you.
So I think one of the reasons why I'm also excited about the emancipator is indeed that I think through the writing and through the platform we hope to build, people are going to learn about and learn about even the debates and come to better understand different forms of you know, of racism. And so certainly I'm hopeful that we will certainly have writers who will be writing on anti-Black and anti-Native racism, which in many ways are foundational to this country's history, but also, you know, anti-Asian racism, also anti-Latinx racism, also even the ways in which racism can harm white people at times, you know, as Heather McGee has shown in her recent book, you know, The Sum of Us, or even the ways in which racism intersects with sexism and classism and homophobia and transphobia. I mean, there's so much ground that we can certainly cover in this, you know, in the Emancipator.
Kimberly, I know these are early days. You guys are still searching for two editors in chief, but I wonder, is there already a conversation you can't wait to have, or a story that you can't wait to do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been hard at work for months on this. I mean, one of the first things that I'm going to be looking into is racism in financial systems. You know, we've heard conversations over things like reparations. And I think for a lot of people, they sort of, you know, they pull away from that, and they, in part because they don't fully understand it, or they can't fully imagine what it might look like. You know, it could be something that is so much different than simply cutting a check. And it needs to be. It needs to be ways to really transform these systems so that they work for everyone. So those are the types of conversations I look forward to starting with this project.
We're going to look forward to engaging further with the two of you as you go along, too. We just heard Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe and inaugural columnist for The Emancipator, as well as Ibram X. Kendi, the founding director of the BU Center for Anti-Racist Research and bestselling author of How to Be an Anti-Racist. Thanks to both of you for coming on Radio Boston today.
Thank you so much, TCA.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Professor Kendi. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Happy Monday. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.